noticed lately that actually what I've always tried to do with the notated pieces is get that sound. Is in a way to compose the haphazard happenings that happen during an indeterminate performance, because stuff happens. Actually, this relates to paragraph 7 that I heard and we talked about before. What I heard, that snapshot in time, could have been notated, but what couldn't have been notated was the fact that it was... You can actually hear that somebody's making the impromptu decision right now while singing.
Mm.
And musical occurrences occur as a consequence of that. And then I realized, this is interesting, because you can't notate that. Or you can, but then it's not that anymore, because it's premeditated, rehearsed, beautiful.
Yes, it's got to arise in the process of performance itself.
Exactly.
It partly arises from the feeling of being in a performance.
The excitation, the expectation, something.
It's the performer's experience of the performance which is different.
Do you find, though, that you do that as well? Or do you find that you are relating in any kind of composing, in indeterminate composing, are you relating to what you do in determinate composing, or vice versa? That you're already, in a way, inspired by these conflicting sound worlds of impromptu sounds and sounds which are rehearsed and
written? Yes, every piece is different, really. Each piece creates a different sort of balance. But I try to be aware of both aspects in every piece. I'm dissatisfied if I've written a completely watertight piece which then turns out exactly as I expected it.
What does that mean, watertight piece?
Well, something which is completely fixed and controlled in every detail, and then turns out to be just as I expected it. Somehow, there's something about being able to predict what's going to happen, which is both satisfying and frustrating. And
why so? Why satisfying? Why frustrating?
Well, I suppose it's satisfying to know that you've been able to achieve what you set out to achieve, but it's also frustrating because you haven't discovered anything, or what you've discovered has all gone into the compositional process and there's nothing left in the performance to discover. And I also have a thing that I very easily get tired of the things I'm writing. I mean, I suppose every composer has this, that the amount of time you spend thinking about music, if you're going over details and working on the thing, you get sort of overloaded with it, and then you get saturated. Your interest is exhausted by the time you finished it. So I like to, as a way of counteracting that psychological impression. I mean, I always have to remind myself that other people are hearing it for the first time, even if I've been over a particular passage, 20 or 30 times while writing it and changed it in many ways. Then, but for other people, it's completely unexpected and fresh. But it's very hard to recapture that for one's own pieces. So for me, one of the attractions of indeterminacy is that I can set up a situation where I can't actually remember what I've done, and I can't predict what's coming next. And this relates, I think, to Morton Feldman, who said somewhere something about each sound should erase the memory of the previous one. So it's not like connecting things as you do when you're listening to classical music or playing classical music. You relate what's happening now to what happened before. You sort of hear the development of the theme in relation to the exposition and so on. You're constantly keeping things in mind and recognizing them when they come back. It's just the opposite of that. It's concentrating so much on each thing as it happens that you're no longer aware of what came before. And I very much like that feeling as well. So I've written a whole series of piano pieces where the compositional process was such that I couldn't predict how it was going to work out, because I used some chance determinations for where individual sounds were going to come. And also, there's no obvious harmonic progression from one sound to the next, or harmonic or melodic. So even now, when I listen to recordings, which I've listened to maybe 10 or 15 times, I don't know exactly what's coming. And I like that idea that the music can be completely fresh and unpredictable each time you hear it. But to do that, you have to somehow erase the feeling of structure.
And let go completely of being the patriarchal figure at the top of the pyramid.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So I'm torn between these two extremes. In some sense, I'm a traditional composer who likes to just write music. And in another sense, I'm a composer who likes to just wait and see and sit back and be surprised. And to be surprised by one's own music is one of the most difficult things to achieve.
the right chords.
Yes. Yeah, it took a while to put all that together, but
very jazzy in a way.
Yes, I think there's a jazz influence. I used to listen to a lot of jazz. The composition of the chords is sometimes like those extended jazz chords. But the actual composition was done largely by chance, by having two large pages of manuscript paper with timings, but nothing written on them, just, you know, each stave 20 or 30 seconds, and then plotting the individual chords onto particular parts of the page. So I didn't begin at the beginning and write through. I just put chords in different places, and then it accumulated. And then I worked out the durations later on according to...
On a timeline, on a grid.
Mm.
Yeah.
It was, they were projected onto a space, as it were, without any preconceived idea of how the continuity was going to work.
And the depressed keys are him depressing, if I understand correctly, he's just playing something and keeping his hand there rather than...
Or using the third pedal. I think this one uses the third pedal. Sometimes I just use the hand manual sustain as well. But that's an area of the piano that I was very interested in these pieces, to get that harmonic resonance from releasing the strings in the lower register and resonating the chords after they've been attacked, and then changing that resonance. That's something Cardew did, in fact, also in some of his early piano music, in the February pieces, for example, a set of piano pieces he wrote in 1959 to 61.
Similar musical material, I doubt it.
Hmm.
Is it?
In a way, I suppose these pieces were a conscious attempt to reconnect with that period after years of doing other things. I sort of felt that there was a whole experimental area here which I wanted to reconnect with, in specifically with the piano. There's something which hadn't been exploited or taken further by Cardew himself. I thought, no, nobody else is writing piano music like this these days.
Thank you.
The material was kind of, I mean, it was worked out with a chart, but I didn't know how the combinations were going to fall. So I worked out the pitches in advance, but not the specific registers. So I might be, in the chart, I might have a kind of column of, say, five or six notes with letter notation, but I would then have to decide how to spread them out on the keyboard. Which registers to use. I mean, I have, say, an E-flat and a C-sharp, but I could put them far apart or close together. Or I made those choices intuitively on the basis of given sets of pitches which came up in the calculations. So there was that chance element in the distribution as well, the same, putting them on different parts of the page. Oh, I should say also that the notation for these pieces it's in a time-space notation. There's no bar lines.
Mm.
And there's no exact indication of duration. So any given, they're just written as a sequence of chords with spaces between them. And each chord can either be sustained until the next chord, or it can be played very short and staccato, or it can be anything in between. So the actual way of joining up the individual notes and chords is left to the performer. So that's just my version of that piece.
And this is both of the pieces, is what you're referring to now?
The first piece was a little bit more specific. The first piece had specific durations written in, I think.
Right.
As far as I remember. But this one didn't have specific durations. It just had the material and left to the performer to join them up. And also had no specific dynamics. So everything was completely free except for the pitches and the relative positions of the sounds.
Mm.
It's very open. It could be performed in all sorts of different ways.
Exactly, that's what I mean. It's just it leaves it for that's a snapshot in time. It could have been done again completely differently just 2 minutes later.
And a different player would do it quite differently.
Quite.
John Tilbury plays them quite differently from the way I do. So that's also something I like.
I don't understand a lot of composers whose music you might say is very good or not very good. It's a taste issue. But when you hear a piece and you're thinking, oh, this is so them, which is very strange to me, because it seems to me, what keeps them surprised? What keeps them? What's the stimulus for a new piece? If you obviously know what's going to happen, it's a completely different psychology. And I find it very difficult personally to go into a mind of such a composer, because it's really one of the things that I realize now. You too try to avoid sometimes as much as possible, just because it's a psychological issue. It's not interesting going into the compositional process knowing well in advance what you're going to get, and yet again, I know that this is really
outcome.
Yeah, and I know that there's a lot of schools composers, most schools composers, in fact, really poo-poo this attitude. It's how dare you compose when you're leaving it up to chance? How dare you? Even today, which is strange to me, do you feel you're alone in this sense?
I still feel there's a certain kind of suspicion about this coming when you run into professional performers and traditionally trained composers, there's still a sort of slight feeling of this is sort of not really what composers do. This is somehow, I suppose there's also a feeling that it's too easy, that you should take responsibility for everything you write. But it's not actually easy at all. It's quite another kind of problem to accept these degrees of indeterminacy. On the other hand, chance is pretty widely recognised now as part of the aesthetics of the 20th century, so it's pretty hard to avoid.
I have to say that I wanted to ask a different question, maybe this is not fair, but my question to you, the initial question, related actually to the fact that I think that much of the relevance of your work, Skempton's work, everything that happened at the time, let's say in the 60s, 70s, was, as you've mentioned yourself, probably guarded by this figure of Cardew. And then suddenly he goes off on a tangent, and in a way completely disregards his work,
quote-unquote,
the
Maoist
period.
He really repudiates it.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that should be, I don't know what to use, it's not a stab in the back, but that's really a shot in the leg, let's say, to somebody that's trying to still do that.
Yes, well, it was a shock, and it left us very exposed in the sense, because now we still wanted to follow this experimental way of working, but somehow the main authority had repudiated and discredited it. It was quite hard to continue with that.
Which happened immediately?
For a while, in the 1970s, yes.
Mm. This was not a gradual process that you saw coming, it's just one day?
Well, it was a matter of months, really, the conversion to Maoism. It took place within a relatively short time, and it was a shock, and it took a while to get going again. I suppose we all retreated into a more traditional kind of way of writing music for a while. But, I wrote a whole set of pieces which were based on traditional melodies, for example, around about the... I wasn't interested in the political, the explicitly Maoist ideology. I was interested in it, but I wasn't devoted to it. Cardew was writing pieces based on Chinese folk songs and so on. And I've always been interested in various kinds of traditional music, and in the 1970s and 80s, I wrote piano pieces based on Scottish melodies, for example, and Greek melodies. I was interested in traditional Greek music, so I did some piano arrangements using that material. That was one aspect. On the one hand, the political aspect, that these melodies are somehow associated with a non-elitist kind of culture. They're genuine popular melodies, so they come from a popular background.
What was the ideal behind that? Not specifically yours, but why Cardew was thinking the music should be for the masses? What was behind that?
I think he just wanted to identify with the people in the Maoist sense, the idea of the true creativity coming from the masses of the people rather than from a particular educated elite.
But so, this is exactly what you were doing. You were a group of people creating people. The actual were coming in and creating the music.
That was
so.
The irony that he no longer recognized that as being a valid expression of his ideals. I mean, there's all sorts of political shades of opinion about different parts of society which come into the Marxist-Leninist analysis, and according to that way of thinking, we were not really the working class, in the sense of the people, in the sense of the working class. We were sort of disenfranchised, disillusioned petit bourgeoisie, I suppose, was the way to characterize it. So we weren't really the people, we were just anarchists or disillusioned intellectuals or something. But so he really wanted to find the music of some kind of real people, and he went to China for that. And there are all sorts of arguments about where that led to. But
and hence the simplicity, maybe.
Yes.
Just so that we really would be for everybody possible.
Well, that was the other idea, that it should be completely accessible, and you shouldn't need to have any musical training to have access to this kind of music. It should be immediate and positive and enjoyable and not problematic and contradictory, in the sense that a lot of modern music is...
Which indeed seems to me, again, this might be, I don't want to make this a personal issue, but it seems to me that this is the way that people like Michael Nyman have taken and Howard Skempton, to make this accessible, which becomes, again, it seems that it was really chic to be the bad boy in the 60s.
Mm.
That was the time to be the extreme avant-garde.
Yes.
And today it's not, really isn't. Today it's what's chic is to sell tickets. We've spoken about him before. Even Richard Ayres at the time said to me that one has to understand how it was to grow up in the aftermath of the 60s.
Mm.
That everything was avant-garde. That it was extremely so. And then everybody just wanted to go back and create simple music and music that's accessible.
Mm.
But suddenly that accessible music is what everybody wants. And you have the soundtrack for the piano, which is immediately classical music, contemporary classical music, and that sells tickets, and hence it's good.
Mm.
It seems very strange to me that maybe being a bad boy was just a phase, just a fad, the cool thing to do.
Well, in retrospect, it may seem like that, but at the time it was like the real... I don't think Cardew was consciously taking up a pose in that sense. He wasn't sort of deciding what the right thing to do was. He was, that's just how he was, and he was in the right place at the right time to fulfill that role. But later on it becomes, as you say, chic and fashionable to be that, and the role somehow gets it gets turned into a sort of pose of a certain kind. But that happened later. That wasn't something Cardew was consciously trying to do, I don't think.
I don't think specifically him, but I mean, it's definitely happening now. And I think that the best example, and you remind me of him very much, maybe not in music, but in personality, is that I had the opportunity to meet Robert Ashley.
Oh, yes.
And he was sitting there in a room full of young composers, and he was by far the most extreme person in the room, including myself, including the teachers, including everybody.
He's maintained a radical...
And yet I'd like to say that so have you. I mean, it's not radical in the sense that your music is offensive or your music is not... It's not even saying anything about the music, but the ideas are the same ideas, and I find that really interesting and in some ways a bit disconcerting, because it seems to me that maybe you don't, because the people who actually do tend to take on these views today are people my age, people who are notably a different generation.
Yes, well, I tend to work mostly with younger composers and performers, and I seem to get on well with people who are now in their 20s, 30s and 40s, and so maybe they've kept this alive in me, that they've created opportunities for me to do things which other people, perhaps by being more conventionally successful, have lost that particular constituency. Like Howard, for example, works almost entirely now with professional musicians, so that both gives him the success which he well deserves, but also somehow limits the possibility of experimentation, which I can do because I work with young people who are still very much with this kind of attitude, which they've maintained and picked up and maintained through the discovery of what was going on in the 60s. So I owe a lot to those younger generations, like Anton Lukasiewicz, for example, the musical director of Apartment House. The fact that he was interested in what I had been doing and was still doing in the 1990s enabled me to write those Apartment House pieces, which I probably wouldn't have done otherwise. I wouldn't have written them unless there had been a group of people who were interested in performing in that way. So it's very much a response to what the opportunities can offer that I've continued to work in that way.
Thank you. Apartment House is a name that comes up quite often. I know that definitely Lawrence Crane mentioned them.
Yes, well,
they've
worked with Lawrence a lot, and
yeah.
they've worked with a whole range of composers, both old and new. But yes, it's very, very much through particular performers that I've been able to maintain that. The Rodri Davis as well, the harpist. He's been always open to new ideas and encouraging me to write new things for him, and responsive to things which are in this tradition of indeterminacy, rather than wanting fixed works which he can show off his technique with. Yes, as I say, I've tried to keep both extremes open and active. Sometimes simultaneously I'm writing indeterminate pieces and fixed notation pieces for different people. Sometimes I'm adapting indeterminate pieces for more fixed groups, and sometimes I'm trying to loosen up fixed pieces to be open to more flexible groups. So there are small pockets of experimentalism scattered around the place, and somehow we're in touch with each other. There's Michael Pizarro in California, he's in touch, and the Wandelweiser people like Manfred Werder in Zurich, and they're all over the world actually, they're particularly in Germany, Switzerland and America. They're a sort of very extreme, a form of extreme minimalism, but without the repetition. Somehow very, very sparse, and often long silences, often lots of silence, very, very reduced. And they work in a very collective way as well. They produce their own concerts and recordings, and they have nothing whatsoever to do with festivals and establishment arrangements. They just exist in a world of their own.
Seems like the way forward, really.
I mean, the situation has arisen just now, actually, that the London Sinfonietta wants to do some of our pieces, which is the first time ever.
That is quite odd.
And they're going to have this 3-day festival in April, quite soon, in fact, at the King's Place.
How about that?
I think it's the 29th, 30th of April and 1st of May. They're doing one program of American experimental music, including Cage and Feldman and I think Frederick Shevsky, who's living in London at the moment.
Is he?
So he'll be around. And maybe some of Christian Wolff's. So there's one program of American pieces, and then there's a program of English experimental music, or British as they always call it. I always prefer to be English than British.
So why is that?
Well, I think there's something specific about English, Irish and Scottish and Welsh all seem to me to be separate identities. And
yeah,
British always seems
yeah.
to be like a political category. I feel more comfortable with English, so although they're actually calling it British experimental music. And that's going to include some Cardew, Autumn 60, I think, of Cardew, which is a sort of seminal indeterminate piece. And those Apartment House suite pieces of mine, or some of them, and some Gavin Bryars, Howard Skempton, Michael Nyman, and Dave Smith, I think.
Well, everybody becomes, everybody gets their 5 minutes of 15 minutes of fame.
That's it. Yes. So it's the first time the London Sinfonietta have ever shown any interest in this, as far as we know.
Quite amazing.
I've got to work with those players, and I'm sort of curious and
so am I.
Slightly apprehensive to know what they'll make of them.
So am I. I'd really like to hope to catch you for a short 5-minute conversation after that experience to see whether it was a good or what you've learned from it, or maybe it's going to be fantastic.
Yes, it might be very good. Yeah. I mean, but they're certainly associated with a completely different kind of music. But they have been broadening out a lot recently. That's true.
They do try. It's just the chances that they take are not They don't. Let's be honest with them. They don't take too many chances.
Well, they've got to sell tickets, haven't they? That's ultimately, it boils down to what the marketing people say.
It really does. And it's very sexy. It's very shiny. And I'm a person that just doesn't like shiny that much. It just doesn't. And then you hear the performances and they're not shiny. And they're lacking. And funnily enough, it seems to me in a very awkward way that the pieces they should be playing are pieces of indeterminate music, because those pieces need very little rehearsal time. A player could go home, understand what they're supposed to do, and then go on stage, and usually the composer would be quite happy. When you're supposed to play Les Espaces Acoustiques, you have to rehearse. You won't get through it if you haven't really rehearsed. It will sound as if it's not rehearsed. So it's strange to me that...
Well, we'll see. We'll see what they make of it.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Interesting.
Indeed.
Thank you. One, two, three.
No, you go. And then you point at us.
No, just put your thumb up.
An hour is an unicode.
Wait a minute, together. Alright. One, two, three.
An hour is an unicode transmission brought to you by Radio Halas.
Again, quickly. One, two, slower.
An hour.
Not so slow.
Normally.
Okay.
Yes, normal.
One, two, three.
An hour is an unechoic transmission brought to you by Radio Halas. An hour is an unechoic.